Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Salman Rushdie, whose latest novel is Shalimar the Clown. Salman Rushdie is the author of several novels, including Midnight's Children, Satanic Verses, collection of essays. Shalimar the Clown brings you back into more into the world of magic realism than, say, Fury did, your last novel. It's about Kashmir, it's about terrorism, it's about the roots of terrorism, it's about a lot of things. What are, in your mind, the origins of this particular book?
I guess there's two things. One is that I always wanted to write about Kashmir and what has been happening there in the last half century or so. For personal reasons, because my family originally came from there. Other than family connection, there's also just the fact that I've been going there all my life and really loving it as a place and being very saddened by what happened to this very peaceful part of the world, peaceful and very beautiful part of the world. So there was that, and it took me a long time to find a way to tell that story. And the moment of sort of light bulb moment, really, was realizing that an encounter I'd had in Kashmir many, many years ago would give me the story, which is that in 1987, in Kashmir, I met a group of traveling players. This is an old tradition in Kashmir. The local name is Bhand Pathar, which literally translates as clown stories. And they are clowns, actors, dancers, you know, tightrope walkers, etc. People who live in, there's two or three villages in Kashmir where the entire village somehow is involved in the troupe and they pass down their skills through the generations. And this has been going on in Kashmir for hundreds of years. They perform traditional plays of bits of Kashmiri history. And there's a famous play about a particularly tolerant king, Zainul Abidin, who united the Hindus and Muslims and so on. Anyway, I met these people and they took me to their village and showed me their lives and etc. And I remember being very moved by them. They had stuck in my head. And then more recently, when I started thinking I really wanted to write about Kashmir, it was their image that came up for me. And then I had another strange epiphany, which is just waking up in the morning with, in my head, the image of a murder in Los Angeles, in which there was the figure of a dead man who was American, and standing over him, a man with a knife, and I realized that the house on whose doorstep this happened was the home of the dead man's daughter. For a long time, I was worrying about who they were, and I knew that the assassin was going to be an Indian, probably, Kashmiri, probably, and that the dead man was going to have been some kind of man of power, so, you know, who eventually emerged as an American ambassador. Initially, I thought that this was actually going to be about a political murder. I thought this was going to be a political assassination and would be a story of that sort. I found I couldn't make that story work. It wasn't interesting enough to me to write. And at some later point, I connected this image of the murder to my memory of these traveling players. And I thought, how much more interesting would it be if this murderer was not some kind of just random assassin, but actually was a boy from this village who had grown up rather a sweet boy, you know, in this village of rather sweet people who I remembered, and yet had turned into this killer. How would it be possible that in a single human life such a great change could take place? And at that point, I began to understand how to tell the story. And it turned out not to be a political murder primarily. It turned out to be a crime of passion.
As you're describing it, it reminds me of something a number of writers said, that in fact creating a book on some level is like piecing pieces of a puzzle together.
Yeah.
Asking questions, and each time you answer, you get another piece.
Yeah, and this book did reveal itself to me like that. You know, gradually I began to see how the bits fitted together. And the secret of it for me was that once I had these four central characters, which are, you know, Max, the ambassador who is killed, Shalimar, the clown who becomes the murderer, the woman who is really the cause of the crime of passion, Shalimar, the clown's wife, the dancer, Bunyi, who is seduced by Max and runs off with him, and the illegitimate daughter of that union between Max and Bunyi. Those four characters, once I had them, I knew that I had a very strong core for the story. And I came to really understand that as long as I listened very carefully to those four characters and what they needed, the story would just emerge. It would just tell itself. And so that, in a way, writing this book was for me that act of listening. You know, I would sometimes not know exactly how to proceed at the end of a day's work. You know, at the next day, I would know that the next day, okay, the next day something has to happen with him or her. And so I would arrive in the morning and listen to what that character required. And it would unfurl. The story would unfurl. And it was actually very exciting to write because of that.
At what point was it early on then because you knew you had to start with the murder, that you would go back and tell each individual story?
Yeah, I mean, I think I always knew that because the murder had been for me so much the given of the book, you know, that it would be right to start there, set up that very powerful image, and then slowly unveil the meaning of the image. And I began to see the book as a five-act play in which each act had one of the four central characters at the heart of it. The character of the daughter, India, is the main character in the first and fifth act, and each of the others has one. And that became, for me, a simple, manageable, strong structure through which to tell the story.
It's funny, the New York Times in their review criticized the idea that Shalimar would be going for this personal retribution. And why couldn't it be political? But it sounds like the reason is that you would have found that boring.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the political is there, you know.
Right, sure.
Because if you're going to write about Kashmir, you can't escape it because it impinges so strongly on people's lives. But I think, you know, the old-fashioned art of the novel, which is about character, you know, that does come first. You know, people don't become men of violence necessarily for ideological reasons. You know, I mean, it's not like they've gone to university and come out with a degree in post-colonial violence, you know, and then they decide to apply it. Some people in Kashmir have joined the men of violence simply for a paycheck, you know, just because the place is very impoverished. And it seemed to me that an injury to the heart, which is also an injury to the pride and to the sense of one's manhood, you know, when a man of much greater power comes and steals the woman you love, particularly in part of the world where issues of honor are very important, it creates in him, in Shalimar, a terrible disturbance in the soul, which means that he has to somehow reconstruct his sense of himself as a man, you know, and that leads him eventually to pick up a gun.
But to some degree, all of the murderous characters in the book have that same attribute, whether it be the torturer, the Indian torturer, the hammer, or the rapist brothers, all of them seem to, the ideology and religious belief kind of recede. Do you think that's really what the violence is about?
I think very few people in these jihadist groups and violent groups are actually convinced ideologues. Some of them are just brutes. They just like beating people up and shooting people and so on. Every violent group, whether it's a mafia clan, you know, or a jihadist group, attracts people for whom violence is likable. Then many of them are people who are very easily led. I mean, they're actually very weak personalities, whose personalities can be easily shaped by others. And there's a scene in the novel where Shalimar the Clown is in one of these kind of re-education training camps, and I tried to show how the very powerful, charismatic figures in these camps are basically telling these young recruits how they have to discard everything they've ever thought and think this instead. And these are malleable people who are responding. Shalimar the Clown is actually unusual in that he's not that malleable. You know, he's there for reasons of his own.
Which he maintains through the book. Yeah.
And he's willing to go along with the agenda. He's happy to kill these people on the way, but actually there's only one person he really wants to kill.
That person is a guy named Max Ophuls, who's an ambassador. And, of course, when I first saw the name Max Ophuls, I kept thinking of La Ronde and Earrings of Madame D and
Lola Montez,
and Letter from an Unknown Woman.
Yeah.
There's obviously a resonance there.
Truthfully, I'm beginning to wish I hadn't called him that, because I think it's maybe made that resonance a bit too overt. You know, and there have been critics who have been kind of, in a way, brought up short by the use of the name. The reason I did it was, well, first of all, Lola Montez is a film about a betrayal of love.
In a circus. You
know? Yeah, and that seemed to me to have an affinity with what I was writing. Also, I liked the fact that in a novel in which many of the characters are unhappy with their names, you know, people don't like their names, they choose prefer nicknames, they choose stage names, and so on. Max is the one character who's perfectly happy with his name, you know, and it's somebody else's name. So I quite liked the irony of that. Also, I liked that Max Ophuls, the film director, wasn't really called Max Ophuls. That was a sort of nom de plume that he took.
Really?
So I thought if he could borrow the name, I can borrow it back, especially in a novel about identities. And when Max, my character Max, in the Resistance, the thing he does is forge identities. You know, he's a forger. So the fact that he's got a forged identity, I quite liked. But the truth is, I had always planned to change the name. When I was making notes for the novel, And I wanted, because Max comes from Alsace on the Franco-German border, this disputed territory, and he's Jewish. And I wanted a name that could be Franco-German. It could be French or German, and it would be a Jewish name. And I remember writing down in my notes, like Max Ophuls, meaning to myself that I would obviously change that name because that was the name of the film director.
And global changes in the novel, yeah. Press a button. Yeah.
Exactly. And what happened is my character just got stuck to the name and wouldn't let me change it. Every time I tried to change it to something else, he didn't like it, and it felt false. You know? And in the end, I thought, you know what, there's just going to have to be two Max Ophulses.
Shalimar's real name is No Man.
Hmm. Well, I quite like the fact that it's an interlingual pun, because Numan, which is how it would be pronounced in Kashmir, is a perfectly ordinary name, which doesn't mean no man, you know. But written down in English, it looks like no man, and I quite liked that. It's a sort of pun between the languages. I don't know, it connected for me to all kinds of things, including the fact that in the Odyssey, you know, that's the name that that Odysseus gives to the Cyclops. That's just a little private joke.
Yeah.
He tells the Cyclops that's what he's called. And, you know, no man has done this to you, et cetera. You know, so I quite like that resonance. But I don't really care whether people get it or not. That was just, for me, is a kind of way of understanding why he was called what he was called.
Well, it's part of a novel subtext that you can kind of look at underneath it all. But on the surface, we do have Kashmir. Your family is originally from Kashmir,
yes,
is that correct?
Yes, on both sides. My father's family left many generations ago and settled in Delhi, but they were ethnically Kashmiri. My mother's family, my mother's parents, actually were born and raised in Kashmir and actually got married in Kashmir. And my grandfather was a doctor and eventually moved south into the rest of India to practice. But we were always brought up very much knowing that Kashmir was, you know, the place we originally came from and was the sort of ancestral home. And we used to, as children, we would go there every summer, and it became the magic space of childhood because it's unusually gorgeous and so on.
What is the terrain like?
In the novel, I have one of the characters describe it as a green sweetmeat caught in a giant's teeth. And it's like that. It's this little lush valley surrounded by the biggest mountains in the world, the Himalayas. Unlike much of India, which is a little bit parched and brown, you know, Kashmir is very, very fertile, moist, green. You know, it has lush green fields and flower meadows and saffron fields and huge glassy lakes and little running streams and honeybees and fruit orchards and woods. And all this with the huge sort of snow-capped mountains.
Almost like a Shangri-La.
Well, it's actually what Shangri-La was based on.
Really?
The main valley of Kashmir, above that, there's the smaller, higher mountain valley, Ladakh, which is what James Hilton used as the model for Shangri-La. So it's always had that feeling of this enchanted paradise. And the thing that I loved about it was, of course, partly that, but also that there had grown up there a culture of extraordinary harmony and tolerance. This is not just me romanticizing, but actually anyone who went to Kashmir as recently as the 60s, 70s, even the early 80s would have told you this, that people came away very moved by the spirit of the place. One of those places in the world where human beings seem to have worked out how to, more or less, how to get on with each other.
But what happened was it suddenly became a pawn in a struggle between Pakistan and India,
yeah.
Hindu and Muslim.
Yeah. The Indian Army, which originally went into Kashmir to protect it against Pakistani attack, stayed in such numbers and with such brutality that it came to be seen like an army of occupation, you know, and people resented that, and that in a way gave a little opening to the radical Islamists coming across the border from Pakistan, who managed to get some support as a result of that, because historically Kashmir was completely immune from radical Islam. It had been the Islam there was of a very mild kind, and as I say, coexisted very well with the Hindu population. So then, yes, the situation became very violent. You had the Kashmiris caught between these two kinds of violence, Islamic terrorism and Indian militarism, and it basically did change the character of the valley.
The Kashmiri part of the book ends in the 90s. What is Kashmir like now?
It's a little tiny bit better. I mean, that's to say, there are less incursions across the border from Pakistan. I mean, General Musharraf seems to have agreed to try and hold those people back. The Indians are beginning to talk, and so are the Pakistanis, in more peaceful terms. But the fact is that this heavily militarized situation is still there. And even more tragically, the thing that really smashed the valley was that the jihadists targeted the Hindu population of Kashmir, terrorized them. And in the end, as is described in the novel, almost all of them fled. Of the 350,000 Hindus who lived in the valley, maybe 300,000 fled and became refugees, I mean refugees in the rest of India, and now live in very badly set up refugee camps, having lost everything, having lost their homes and their lands and their possessions and so on. And that is a damage that is very difficult to undo, you know, because even if there were peace in Kashmir tomorrow,
they'd be still be gone.
Yeah, you can't see how they'd go back. Who would give them back their houses and their lands and their property? And even if somebody would, how would they then go back to living in harmony with people when they had just been driven from their homes? I mean, to put it simply, after World War II, the Jews who survived the Holocaust did not return to Germany. And you see in Germany today, and many Germans will say to you, the hole that they feel left by the absence of Jewish culture, which had been so much at the heart of Germany, you know. And I think something like that you feel now if you go to Kashmir. You feel this hole left by the absence of the Hindu culture, even though the Muslims were the majority.
You're listening to an interview with Salman Rushdie, whose latest novel is Shalimar the Clown. A couple of small points, Salman Rushdie. You have two characters called the Pandit and the Sarpash.
Sarpanch.
What are they?
Oh, well, Pandit is just a... he's called Pandit Pyarelal. He's actually the father of the dancing girl,
right.
Bunyi. Pandit is just the local word for Kashmiri Brahmin Hindus.
Okay.
See, Jawaharlal Nehru was a Pandit. Ah. It's actually where the Western English language word Pandit comes from, that because Pandits were always known for their scholarship and their learning, and they were the teachers, educators. You know. Anyway, so Sarpanch, which is translated in the book, it's just the word for a village headman. In an Indian village is run by what is called a panchayat. Panch means five. So a panchayat is a ruling council of five people. This is the structure all around India, how villages are run. So you have this panchayat of five people, and the headman is the sarpanch, the first amongst the five. And that, in this novel, is the father of Shalimar the Clown. The character, a little bit based on my grandfather.
And the town of
Pachigam
on the Muscadoon River, that's fictional.
That's fictional. There's no such river and there's no such town, but there are many streams like it, these very fast-running, trout-rich streams. And I know of at least three villages in Kashmir which are villages of traveling players, where these kind of families live and pass down their skills.
In a review by Christopher Hitchens, he made the connection, which I made in my own mind and was going to ask you about, between Pachigam and Macondo.
I hadn't really thought about Macondo when I wrote the book, because to my mind, this was not a place of fable in the way that Garcia Marquez uses it, but a real place. I mean, it's got a fictional name, but, you know, so towns and novels often do. But it seemed to me that the reality of it was what I wanted to convey. I mean, I'm a great lover of Garcia Marquez. For me, the interesting thing, and the thing that I think does link it to Macondo, is that most of my writing about India has been about big cities. You know, I mean, I've been a very urban writer most of my life, because that's been where I've lived. But I'm aware of the fact that in India, most people do not live in cities. Most people live in small villages. And the life of the village was a thing that I had not spent much of my career entering. You know, and I thought I'd better do it. And actually, for me, one of the most pleasurable things about this book was creating these two Kashmiri villages side by side, Pachigam, where the actors live, and the neighboring village of Shirmal, which starts out as being a village of cooks, because Kashmiris also love to eat.
And these banquets, are they real?
They're real.
Really?
Yeah.
35-course banquets?
36 courses minimum, yes. It's called, its real name is the Vazvan.
Have you done one?
Oh, sure. I mean, of course, they're special occasion things. You know, people have them at weddings and other moments of celebration. And there are chefs and families of chefs that specialize in this. And again, those skills are handed down. There's also what I call in the novel the banquet of 60 courses maximum. That exists, too. There's a larger, expanded version of the Vazvan, which is called colloquially the Super Vazvan.
When they have 60 courses, each course has to be tiny, right?
No, you just have to be really hungry.
And they must last all day.
They do. They last for ages, and you feel, you know, replete beyond bearing at the end. And also, Kashmiris are incredibly fond of meat. So an enormous number of these courses are meat courses. You know, meat ice cream. I mean, not really. But it feels like that. That if you're a vegetarian, there's relatively, I mean, of those 60 courses, maybe 45 would be meat courses. You know, and then, you know, five would be desserts. that leaves you with a few vegetables.
Character of Max Ophuls fits into real history. He is the Indian ambassador after John Kenneth Galbraith. Who actually was?
Actually, it was Chester Bowles who followed Galbraith. I had to obviously push them apart in time in order to make room for my fictional ambassador. So in my novel, Galbraith stops being ambassador a little earlier than he really did, and Chester Bowles has to wait a while. But in a way, they both lent me a little bit, at least for that part of Max, which is the ambassador to India, because Galbraith, like Max, was very, very, very popular in India, probably the most popular Indian American ambassador there ever was to India, partly because he was very, very smart, and partly because he really got India, he really understood it and liked it. He came up with this famous phrase where he described India as functioning anarchy. And I have Max coming up with a similar phrase, which is he describes India as chaos making sense, which is a kind of nod at Galbraith. Chester Bowles was an ambassador who tried very hard to persuade LBJ that Lyndon Johnson, whose fondness was for the dictator of Pakistan, General Ayub Khan, Chester Bowles tried to persuade him he was wrong, and that actually it was much more in America's interest to move closer to an association with India, not to Pakistan. But Lyndon Johnson resisted this very strongly. And so a little bit of Chester Bowles' worldview and Galbraith's glamour, if you like, you know, are both presents in Max.
Max's early life, which we get into about a third to halfway through the book, and it takes us in a completely different direction, is as a resistance fighter in France. Mm-hmm. Two things. First off, the research, the writing of that. You went over there.
I did more research for this book than I've ever done. I mean, whether it was Strasbourg or San Quentin prison or indeed Kashmir.
Obviously, subtexts involving the nature of resistance, whether it be the insurgency in Iraq or the resistance, however minimal, in Kashmir between these two forces. And here we have the resistance, the insurgences, the good guys in France.
Yeah. Well, I just thought one of the interesting things that I could do in this novel was to say, why don't just have a look at this and look at how historical context changes the kind of moral judgments we make about events which are in fact identical. You know, so in occupied France, you had an army of occupation being resisted by a violent insurgency. And we call that an act of heroism, because we know that the Nazis were bad and that the liberation of France was good. Meanwhile, in Kashmir, you have an army, the Indian army, that came ostensibly to protect and liberate, but stayed to oppress. And it is being fought by a violent Islamist insurgency, about which one has much, much more misgivings, and which is not treated as heroic. And of course, I mean, one doesn't need to draw the parallel, but it exists, obviously, to Iraq, where there's an army which came ostensibly to liberate, and increasingly comes to feel like an army of occupation, and is being fought by an increasingly violent insurgency. So I think, for me, a novel is not the place to point the finger and say, here's how you should think about this. But I think it's just interesting to show readers that when you change the historical context of an event, the moral content of the event changes too. And what is that about? Why do we do that? You know, given that exactly the same actions are taking place, the same kinds of sabotage acts and violent acts in all three contexts, whether it's Iraq or Kashmir or the French resistance.
You know? Or we could throw in Palestine, Israel as well. Yeah.
And yet we make completely different kinds of moral assumptions about these situations. And isn't that strange?
What I find strange is that even when confronted with what you're saying, which becomes obvious here, but I mean, it was obvious to me long before I read this book, that people still feel the need to hold on to those moral distinctions.
Yeah, well, I think the great thing that a novel can do is to make you rethink your moral choices, you know? And one of the things in this novel that I feel very proud of is that I think with all four of the main characters, you cannot make an easy moral decision about them. You know, one of the things that with Shalimar Clowney, he's a man who becomes a terrorist, you know. And yet, I think because when I wrote him his youth as this time of great sweetness, you know, I think the reason for calling the novel Shalimar the Clown and not Shalimar the Assassin or Terrorist, you know, is because I wanted people to retain that memory of the boy he was, you know, when they consider the man he became. And I think it makes your response to him more complex, you know, and therefore richer, because, put it like this, if he was just a bad guy, you know, if he was just a, here he is, he's a killer, he's a bad guy, you don't have to like him. There's no trick to that. You get nothing from that you didn't already bring to it. Whereas, because a cartoon, an openly evil person, no longer has the power of moral choice. You know, that the roadrunner can only be the roadrunner. The coyote can only be the coyote.
Right.
But if the person is a real human being who you've come to care about as a human being, then that is a person who retains the capacity for moral choice. And therefore, when he makes a reprehensible choice, you actually feel it more deeply.
But his choice is an age-old choice of revenge for his wife being taken.
Yeah, it's a revenge tragedy. You know, yeah. It really it is, and it's one of the ways of defining tragedy is, as we were saying about Kashmir, so about the personal. Sometimes you break things you can't fix. At the level of his love for his wife, there's a moment in the novel when she, which for me actually is the pivotal scene in the novel, when the thing with Max breaks down as anybody could have told her it would. You know, this man of great power is not looking for a lifetime relationship with this pretty young Kashmiri village girl. And everybody could guess this except her. But anyway, when she is dumped and she returns to her village devastated and abject and asking for mercy and forgiveness from her village and from her husband, he can't forgive her. You know, and I think the tragedy of the novel is in that scene. It's that, you know, actually I thought when I wrote the scene, you know, he probably still loves her. You know, and in spite of the fact that he still loves her, he now hates her more than he loves her. And that problem, you know, the victory of hatred over love, the fact that the broken thing cannot be put together again, you know, that's, as I say, that's one way of defining what tragedy is.
In a slightly more political sense, though, when we begin to identify with Shalimar, we don't feel that he's bad, then we take it one step further. How do we feel about someone like Muhammad Atta, who I'm sure had his own reasons?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I think we feel about him as we feel about him. I mean, I have pretty negative feelings towards him.
Well, yeah.
I have to say. But what I think is, in a way, just suspend the issue of judgment for a second. And just, instead of that, think about, try to work out who he was and where he came from and why he did what he did. And I think, you see, the answer to that is not available from the news. The answer to that is available through the old novelistic investigation of character. You know, why this man and not that man? Why does this man become a terrorist when the guy standing next to him rejects that road? You know, and that is what I wanted to get into. The question of judgment remains. Characters, readers will make their judgments. You know, readers don't need to be told by me what to think about a murderer.
Is there any way that you could ever get to a point where you could apply that same, Salman Rushdie, could apply that same sort of logic to, say, the people who issued the fatwa against you?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've obviously spent a lot of time thinking about that, you know, and in a way, that decade and a half of reflection on themes of fanaticism and violence, you know, is certainly behind creating the characters in this book. The problem with what happened to me is that the people who did that were completely unfamiliar with me. You know, they didn't know who I was. They hadn't read my book. And the reason for the Khomeini fatwa essentially was that, you know, he was an old and dying man who had recently suffered a terrible defeat, you know, in the Iran-Iraq war. And the revolution in Iran was tottering a little bit, and he was looking for a way of rallying the troops, and I turned out to be it. It's my bad fortune to be Khomeini's last stand. It's my belief and information that he never even held a copy of the Satanic Verses in his hands. There was no translation of it in Farsi. He was really, really unwell. You know, he wasn't in the position to read 600-page English literary novels. So his condemnation of the book happened completely randomly. You know, a lot of people were told things about me which were quite simply not true, and which inflamed feelings. There was a moment there of very, very inflamed feelings. And I think one of the pleasures now, 16 years later, is that as those feelings have died down, so one discovers that actually there are an enormous number of Muslim readers, amongst others, who really like my work, who actually really like the Satanic Verses. I get letters from them all the time. So I've managed to prove the thing that I always suspected, which is that actually this was politically motivated rather than being some very widespread feeling in the community. What I've felt, especially because in those years so many people, you know, so many literary people supported me in all kinds of courageous ways, including, you know, right here in Berkeley, where, you know, as we know, Cody's bookstore was attacked and so on. I felt if I've got this extra little burst of celebrity because of what happened, the thing to do is to put that to work. You know, therefore, when I was asked to become involved with Pan American Center, that was something I thought was a very good way to put that well-knownness, you know, to use. And as a result, now that I'm president of American Pen, we can actually use it. We can use it to work on behalf of other writers who need spotlights, such as the one that was shone on me, but don't get it, you know. And we've had very good results. For instance, recently in Australia, a case was brought to my notice about an Iranian writer and activist who had fled to Australia but had lost his appeals for asylum and was on the verge of being deported back to Iran, where he would have been in terrible trouble, you know. But he'd lost all his appeals, and we at Pan American Center were brought into the case very late. And yet we wrote a letter which I signed, and we know, because we were told afterwards, that that letter with my signature was the thing that persuaded the Australian authorities to reopen the case, and he was granted asylum. And I mean, I don't know whether we saved his life, but we certainly saved him from a lot of very, very bad trouble. And that's what it's for. You know, if I've got this stuff, this well-known name now, I mean, I'm happy to get tables in restaurants, you know. I mean, that's fine. And, you know, and seats at the ball game, I'm not knocking it. But the real use of it, I've found in the last 3-4 years, has been to put it to work on behalf of other people who need it, as once I needed it.
You've been listening to an interview with Salman Rushdie, whose latest novel is Shalimar the Clown. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.